Iran's top diplomat visits four Persian Gulf states as Tehran extends a diplomatic campaign to reduce its isolation in the region and beyond. But as we'll hear from the American Enterprise Institute, that campaign may not bring the economic benefits Iran is hoping for.
It's not necessarily a replacement for sanctions relief, which is what a lot of Iranian officials have framed this as.
Plus, we'll ask an Israeli analyst how Iran is helping Palestinian terror groups that Israel says have built an Iranian stronghold in the West Bank. And why did flash floods in the Iranian capital this month lead to a serious water shortage? A U.S.-based researcher gives us his view.
One big problem is that the Iranian authorities always react to problems, and they're not proactive.
From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Iran. Good morning. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. Iran appeared to make progress in improving its strained relations with Arab neighbors last week when the top Iranian diplomat Hossein Amir Abdollahian completed a tour of four Persian Gulf states. Before setting out on his visits to Qatar, Oman, Kuwait, and the United Arab Emirates, Amir Abdollahian tweeted his hopes for expanding relations with neighboring countries that he said enjoy economic and commercial strengths. His Gulf mission built on earlier diplomatic initiatives, including Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi's visits to Syria in May and to three Latin American allies in the first half of June. Iran also won Saudi approval to reopen its embassy in Riyadh this month for the first time in 7 years. Keita Fitzpatrick is an Iran analyst at the American Enterprise Institute. I asked her in a Monday phone call how she measures the success of Iran's diplomatic strategy.
This is kind of all part of Iran's, or the Raisi administration specifically, neighborhood policy, which is something that he articulated at the beginning of his inauguration, which is really kind of an economically focused policy centered on building relations with regional and extra-regional states. And the theory goes that it supports Iran's heavily sanctioned economy and can kind of help with that regard. So it has been successful in that they have normalized relationships with the KSA back in March.
The KSA being Saudi Arabia.
Yes. And there are talks that Iran is also set to normalize ties with Egypt and Bahrain, although we haven't really seen anything materialize on that front. So it's been very successful in that they have been able to normalize ties and that there are talks of a flurry of economic activities with specifically Saudi Arabia and potentially these other states as well. However, it's not necessarily a replacement for sanctions relief, which is what a lot of Iranian officials have framed this as. So successful in that they've achieved their objective, although just kind of on a superficial level. However, it's unclear whether that will really help the Iranian economy in the long term.
Well, in what ways does Iran hope and expect that these improved relations with Arab nations will actually make an impact in its pretty weak economy?
So there are a few different ways. I think one is just having that capital flow, and that's really important, and they've already taken victory laps. We've seen Raisi and other Raisi administration officials talk about the regional normalization efforts as a victory. It's already accomplished its goal, which it has not yet, at least as far as we can see. But they're also hoping to take advantage of other normalization efforts. So Syria is an example here, to potentially circumvent sanctions and possibly support Iranian-backed militias and militant groups operating in Syria. So that's another way that this works out here, is if Syria normalizes ties with a bunch of Arab states, then a bunch of those funds can go through Syria and then back into Iran. So it becomes a really effective way of circumventing sanctions.
One thing that your team at AEI has noted recently is a strengthening of the Iranian currency since the start of May, when Iran began this latest series of diplomatic moves with the visit of Raisi to Syria, and then Raisi going farther afield to Latin America in the last couple of weeks to visit his allies there. Why do you believe that these diplomatic moves are linked to a strengthening of the rial?
Yeah, that's a great point. So we saw a huge improvement in the rial after we saw movement on the normalization with Saudi and Iran. That was a really big inflection point because the currency was struggling quite a bit at that point. It is, I think, really about the perception, because the Iranian economy is so flawed and has been failing for so long. This kind of boosted a little bit of confidence back into the market. The problem with that, though, is that it doesn't change the systemic issues with the Iranian economy, which is that there are just so many parasitical organizations, and it's really quite difficult to make impactful changes that will really affect livelihood issues that Iranians are seeing right now. So another flip side of this coin is that we've seen the currency go up, but we've also seen reports that currency also went down when there was news about the Wagner attempted coup in Russia. A lot of people tied those currency drops in Iran to the events that were going on in Russia. Now, I don't know how true that is, but it goes to show that there's a flip side to this coin as well.
Moving on to a different topic, actually. The American Enterprise Institute has noted a significant increase in anti-government protests in Iran's southeastern province of Sistan and Balochistan last Friday, coming after the weekly Friday prayers. What can you tell us about what is going on there?
It's a great question. We were really interested to see, since late September, there's been a really steady every week anti-regime protests in Zahedan and Sistan and Balochistan province. We've seen that consistently, but what was interesting about last Friday on the 23rd is that we saw this protest activity expand to other places in Sistan and Balochistan as well, so about six cities total. This followed reports of an alleged attempted assassination on Abdul Hamid, who is a very prominent Sunni cleric in Zahedan, who really spearheads a lot of anti-regime or controversial sermons on his Friday prayer sermons. So we can't say for sure whether that activity is correlated, but we did find that interesting that there was the convergence of that incident and then a huge uptick in protest activity in that province.
Why does it seem that protests in this province, Sistan and Balochistan, are stronger and more enduring than anti-government protests we've seen in other parts of Iran lately?
It's been fascinating to see. Sistan and Balochistan is somewhat of a different province compared to others, and the residents there have had to endure quite a bit. It is a historically marginalized community there. They are religiously marginalized as well, and the economic conditions there are quite difficult. Iran has historically sidelined this province in that regard. And we're also seeing environmental conditions really ramp up there in a way that is difficult for these residents. We're talking climate change, water, there's a lot of sandstorms and things like that just make it a really difficult place to live. And I think that we see that reflected in the anti-regime sentiments and protests that we see manifest in that area. I think Abdul Hamid, who's the prominent Sunni cleric in Zahedan, he capitalizes on this quite well. And his sermons have, undoubtedly played a role in the consistent protest turnout that we've seen in Zahedan.
Well, that's certainly an area that we should keep an eye on. Geeta Fitzpatrick, Iran team lead and analyst at the American Enterprise Institute's Critical Threats Project, joining us on the line from Washington, D.C. Great to have you again on Flashpoint Iran.
Thank you so much for having me.
Israel is drawing attention to what it calls an Iranian terror stronghold that has formed in the West Bank city of Jenin, where Israeli forces have staged deadly raids in recent months targeting Iran-backed Palestinian militants. The latest raid happened on June 19th, with seven Palestinians killed, including militants and at least one civilian, and eight Israeli soldiers wounded. It was followed a day later by a Palestinian terror attack that killed four Israeli civilians in a West Bank settlement. Israeli ambassador to the U.S. Michael Herzog tweeted after the attack that Jenin has become the main springboard of terror attacks against Israelis. The leaders of the main Palestinian terror groups, Hamas and Islamic Jihad, were in Tehran last week for separate meetings with Iran's president. What kinds of support have they been receiving from Iran beyond the photo ops? I put that question on the phone to Middle East researcher Dina Lisniansky of Tel Aviv University.
So it is no coincidence that the leaders of these two Palestinian terrorist organizations are visiting in Tehran and meeting with their chief benefactor, basically. The point is that Iran has made it a strategic priority to arm and fund Palestinian terrorist organizations in the West Bank, especially Hamas and the Islamic Jihad, which are the two main organizations here. Also, we know that there is a very important role that Iran is playing in the more than 2-year armed West Bank uprising right now. And Iranian support is basically the most critical contributor and founder to this violence. So we know that Iran remains the primary patron for both Hamas and Islamic Jihad in Palestinian Authority. And this regime is traditionally providing with cash and weapons and training and other key assistance. In the recent years, we have witnessed this assistance also in coordination between terror groups. There is an attempt to rise the level, to escalate the level of violence in Israel. So these groups are basically relying on Iran to connect between all of them, whether it's from financial point of view or any other kind of coordination. And you were asking about the monetary and the material aid that actually comes from Iran.
Yes. I was wondering if you could try to give our audience a sense of, in practical terms, how cash is sent from Iran to these groups and how even weapons are sent when you consider that there's a big gap of territory between Iran and the West Bank. You know, you have Iraq, you have Jordan. So how are those arms getting in?
Absolutely. So first I will speak about the money, then we'll talk about the arms. So first in numbers, Iran is transferring around $100 million every year to Hamas and Islamic Jihad, according to many, many different sources. One of the sources being Nahale, who is the head of the Islamic Jihad group, and he resides basically abroad. And so the vast majority of this money is used by Hamas and the Islamic Jihad to further enhance their military wings instead of aiding the civilian population at the Gaza Strip. And I also really would like to give you an essence of things by telling you that Hamas can actually give some of this money, or at least the majority of this money, yes, to the civil population in Gaza. But the Islamic Jihad doesn't do this at all. We are talking only about a military organization that doesn't have anything to give to the civil populations. They didn't have to feel accountable to anyone. So we are talking about a very high sum of money, but it is not as high as the sum that is given by Iran to Hezbollah, for instance. Hezbollah is receiving on average $1 billion annually. And in the last few years, there has been a slight change because in Iran, there were a lot of economical difficulties. So basically, Iran reduced the sum of the money that Hezbollah gets, and Hezbollah is getting only $800 million per year. But the budget for the Gaza Strip and the West Bank, meaning for Hamas and the Islamic Jihad, it remains unchanged. So we're talking about $70 million to Hamas and $30 million to the Islamic Jihad annually from Iran. Now, the question is, how are they getting this money? We understand that normal banks would not transfer terror money. So this money needs to get through other channels. And one of these channels is, well, charities. So it's very easy to transfer money through Islamic charities. This is something that terrorist organizations, well, they do it often. And I will give you the names of those charities. So the first group that sends money to the Gaza Strip is Al-Ansar Charity Foundation, which is established by the Islamic Jihad and was established in 2001. It is very well-funded. And it is used as an arm of Iran with which it moves money into Gaza. Now, there is another foundation, which is named the Imam Khomeini Relief Foundation, and it is a whole other funding mechanism. We know that this foundation's Lebanese branch was placed under sanctions by the U.S. for helping fund Hezbollah about 15 years ago, and this foundation regularly gives humanitarian aid to Gaza. Iran is basically using this activity to maintain its connections with Hamas and with Islamic Jihad as well in Gaza. Now, another channel to receive money from Iran is through Gazan money changers. We are talking about millions of dollars to Hamas, Islamic Jihad, and other Gazan terror organizations. And all of this money was marked as Iranian transfers. By the way, the main body that transfers this money is the Quds Force. So we are talking about a whole different branch of Iranian activity that transfers this money.
Well, could you just explain for our audience briefly how weapons are getting from Iran into the Palestinian areas, such as the West Bank, and why is Israel highlighting the West Bank now as having an Iranian terror stronghold?
So there is a very widely known fact that weapons are being smuggled through the Lebanese and Syrian border right now into Israel. And there are a lot of channels to smuggle those weapons. Of course, they are weapons that are being basically funded by Iran and also delivered by Iranian Shiite militias that exist on the Israeli borders right now, whether it's from the side of Lebanon or Syria. Now, about the fact that Jenin, specifically in the West Bank, that became something of an Iranian stronghold. The thing is that one of the main Islamic terrorist groups that exist in Jenin and the lead groups of people in Jenin is the Islamic Jihad. And one of the things that the Islamic Jihad does very well is that it has a wide network of terrorist cells inside the Palestinian areas in the West Bank. And these cells often include children, which are recruited from a very young age. This is why we hear on the news all the time about the really young age of youth and children that are being wounded or sometimes even killed by the Israeli army. It's not that the Israeli army is trying to kill those people. We're talking about the fact that the terrorists are getting younger. This is a huge problem. And we're talking about as many as 10,000 participants per session in summer camps, where right now it's June, it's the end of June. So Islamic Jihad is running summer camps for children in both Gaza and the West Bank.
Well, thank you very much for illuminating the Iranian connection to these Palestinian terror groups. Dina Lisniansky, an expert on Mideast affairs at Tel Aviv University and Shalem College, speaking to us from Jerusalem. Thank you for being with us on Flashpoint Iran.
Thank you.
You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Iran. I'm Michael Lippin. Flash floods in northern Iran in the middle of this month caused major headaches for the Iranian capital, cutting water supplies to many residents. An Iranian energy official told VOA Persian that the supply cuts left homes and businesses without safe drinking water and forced authorities to send tanker trucks into various neighborhoods to provide purified water. Nick Ahankosar is a U.S.-based independent researcher focusing on Iran's water resources. I asked him in a phone call on June 22nd how flash flooding led to water shortages in Tehran.
One important factor is that we have lots of floods, especially flash floods in Iran. And in many areas, they know how to manage these flash floods, but they have avoided actually managing them because of water policy, water management policy, and bad water governance. But the thing that happened in Tehran was the path of water from the Karaj Dam to Tehran was blocked. So that was what I heard happen. And because the Karaj Dam provides water for a big part of the population, they weren't able to provide water from other reservoirs to the western part of Tehran and the town of Karaj during the first few days after the flood. So because of that, the Tehran Water Treatment Company was not able to get the water to the consumers on time. And that created a domino effect, actually, that not just some parts in the western part of Tehran, but some parts in northern and central Tehran did not have enough water because they had to actually get water to the citizens who are out of water.
Can you explain for our listeners, how does this domino effect work?
Look, when something negative happens in the whole cycle, the water management system is not able to correct the problem that has occurred or the impact of the flash flood, for instance. So what happens is that to provide water for part of the population, when you don't have enough water in other reservoirs, you have to find a way to do that. By redirecting water from this area to another area, some of the citizens in, let's say, eastern part of Tehran and central part of Tehran are deprived of their own water rights at that moment. So that causes a new problem. So all these problems happen one by one, one after another. And that's the domino effect that actually put many citizens in trouble last week.
Can you also tell us about the water infrastructure in and around Tehran? You mentioned reservoirs and dams. What other elements are there to this whole universe of water management?
We have a number of dams around Tehran that some of them are not in the same river basin as Tehran is. That means we have interbasin water transfer, like from the Talavan Dam. They bring water that is supposed to go to another area to Tehran, or from the Lar Dam that's near the Damavand Mountain. They bring water to Tehran. The other source would be the groundwater resources that we have in the Tehran alluvial fan, that Tehran is actually built on that big alluvial fan. But because of overdrafting through the years, it's in a troubling situation.
So what does overdrafting mean?
When we have an aquifer, we have some annual recharge that's usually natural recharge, the water you get from melting snow or floods that goes inside the aquifer. And then you have the water that you pull out of the aquifer for agriculture, for drinking water, potable water, or for your industry, or for irrigating your orchards or your flowers, whatever you have for it. When the amount of water that is drafted and brought out of the aquifer is more than the water that's naturally recharged, the balance changes. And the imbalance at the end causes so many problems, including land subsidence. And Tehran is in the worst situation right now because of this overdraft, and the land is subsiding. So you have less and less pore spaces to collect water under the ground. And what has happened through the years is that because Tehran has lost lots of its groundwater resources, whenever there's a problem, they have to dig deeper wells, and you're not sure if you actually get to the clean water you're expecting on time. So Tehran was not ready for this problem that occurred near the Karaj Dam.
Why have Iranian authorities in the Tehran area not been ready for these issues and not been able to handle them well?
One big problem is that the Iranian authorities always react to problems, and they're not proactive. They don't think about something beforehand and create the infrastructures for that area before they hit the wall. One major problem is population. After 1989, when Rafsanjani became the president and Karabakhchi became Tehran's mayor, the population grew enormously. And the water resources in the area were not enough for this big population. And the other thing was the pipelines we had were corroded through time. And Tehran usually loses over 30% of its fresh water through these corroded pipelines. So that's another major problem. And because of the unsustainable development of the city, water consumption rate has grown a lot. And so many major buildings have been built, constructed, so many skyscrapers, and water consumption rate in Tehran is more than any city in Iran. So we have, one, the high consumption rate of the population, two, bad infrastructure, and three, the bad management that we've seen from politicians and water managers. And they have no alternatives for what's happening right now. And even if they ask people to consume less and less water because of the mistrust that we have between the population and the government, many people would not actually listen. So things will certainly go south in the near future.
Well, Nick Ahankosar, independent water issues analyst and researcher on the line from the Washington, D.C. area, thank you very much for being with us on Flashpoint Iran.
It was a pleasure, Michael.
That's all for our show. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. I appreciate you joining us. We'll have another Flashpoint Iran for you next week.